All right, you have the cooler, suntan lotion, towels, umbrella, some snacks, and don't forget that beach permit. Wait, you don't have one? Welcome. We're glad you're a part of the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. I hope you had a nice weekend. I had to head up north a bit. There was sleet and there was snow. Insane. And so thinking about the beach today and the summer seems kind of strange, especially right now when I look out the window. I mean, it's dark out there and it looks like the rain's going to come down soon. But eventually it will get warmer. It will get drier. And at some point, many of us are going to pack up the old jalopy and we're going to haul 50 pounds worth of stuff to go sit at the beach for a few hours. Now, the questions we have are, which beach will you go to? Do you go to a public beach, a state park? Maybe you go to a town beach. If you do, is it because you're a resident and you have a permit, or do you buy a daily pass? The question of who gets to use public beaches has been contentious for decades now. Charges of racism, discrimination, towns saying they're simply trying to protect their parks for local taxpayers and residents. So let's get into it. Andrew Carl is an associate professor of history and African American studies at the University of Virginia. He wrote the book Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Culp and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. And now you might remember the name Ned Culp. He got a lot of people around who really angry many years ago. We're talking about decades ago when he tried to open up the state's private beaches to minorities and poor people from the cities. Professor Carl, thanks for being with us. We're very grateful you give us a few minutes today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
Professor, who is Ned Culp?
So Ned Culp was
I'm sorry. He's still alive, right?
Yes. Okay. He's still alive and kicking. He lives in a cabin up in Bark Hampstead. He was a social activist who in 1964 started the anti-poverty organization called Revitalization Corps that was based in Hartford, but soon spread to chapters nationwide. And the goal, broadly speaking, of what Revitalization Corps aimed to do was to shake middle-class white Americans out of their apathy toward the problem of poverty and get them more involved in solving the persistent problems of racism and poverty in America. Very much a kind of idealistic vision of how we can address, in particular, folks in Connecticut could address the mounting problems facing the state's poorer population. He later then began to focus his attention on the problem of beach access is one of the ways in which we began to see the obstacles that poor people and people of color encountered in their day-to-day lives.
Just to clarify, what years did this take place? You said back in the 60s?
Yeah, so he began Revitalization Corps in 1964, but during the initial years, it was broadly focused on a wide range of issues. I mean, really kind of, you know, from day to day, their focus shifted in response to the problems and demands, mainly facing the African American community in Hartford's North End. But it was beginning in the early 1970s and really continuing throughout the 1970s that he made a particular focus, especially during the summer months, on the problem of beach access in the state and how that negatively impacted the state's minority population.
What were the beaches like back then?
Well, you know, there were out of the 253-mile shoreline along the state of Connecticut, less than 7 of those miles were open to the public. The state beaches routinely on summer weekends, Hammonasset routinely filled beyond capacity before noon, which in turn forced folks who weren't fortunate enough to live in one of those shoreline towns or belong to one of the 184 private beach associations and clubs also along the state shoreline. If they weren't fortunate enough to be a part of that kind of exclusive club, then they had very few options in terms of where they could go and spend the day at the beach. Most of the shoreline towns either had, you know, if they didn't have an outright ban on non-residents, they had a whole host of obstacles meant to make it very difficult for non-residents to be able to use the public beaches. So in many respects, you know, public beaches in Connecticut in the 1970s were really public in name only.
So what did Ned Culp and his friends do?
Well, initially the idea was is to try to get, in particular, you know, privileged white families, especially those living in some of the private beach associations along the shoreline, to open their doors up to this underprivileged children, to welcome them onto their beaches on a voluntary basis. But as he encountered resistance to this, and as towns and communities reacted hostily to this campaign to help, you know, facilitate greater access to public beaches and shorelines, he went from asking permission to demanding it as a right, and began shifting toward these high-profile protests aimed at calling attention to the problem that many of the, much of the state shoreline was practically off limits to the poor and people of color. And so that, again, went from being something that, he almost kind of accidentally became an activist on this issue. And it was really in response to what he saw firsthand when he tried to bring a busload of children down to the shore for a day at the beach.
I know from reading part of your book, I just got it the other day, but in the past when I haven't spoken with you about this, but I've spoken with others, that didn't go over well, did it?
No, it did not. No, he really touched a nerve in many of these shoreline communities that were not accustomed to having protests being waged on in their towns, not accustomed to being called racist in their policies. It was very much, there was a kind of a real tension in the air, especially during the summer months. And many of these communities learned to fear the sight of revitalization corps, buses and vans rambling into town, and them getting out and demanding access to the town beaches.
And for those who weren't around back then, the mid to late 60s, early 70s, there were protests across the country. There were riots. There were some people just plain old scared.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, one thing that's worth noting here, that the Kerner Commission report, which came out in 1968, which looked at the underlying causes of urban unrest and the uprisings that had taken place in cities in previous years, though they really identified the lack of access to decent places for public recreation, the lack of pools, parks, playgrounds, and urban black neighborhoods as being one of the underlying sources of unrest. And in particular, it's worth noting that some of the so-called riots that erupted in cities began with conflicts over access to places of public recreation. And so, the denial of this basic kind of right of childhood and something that is that many of us take for granted during the summer months was something that was in itself a source of unrest in urban black America, and something that Ned Cole, as someone who was trying to address these problems, saw as a real need that he was hoping to help alleviate by providing, days at the beach for children who lived on Hartford's North End. So, a lot of these issues kind of converged literally and figuratively on the state shoreline during the summer.
You're going to be with us. We have a break coming up in about 3-4 minutes, and I'm happy to know that you're going to be with us after the break, because I have a number of other questions for you, and I'm enjoying the conversation. How is the situation today compared to the 60s and the 70s?
Well, many of your listeners might be familiar with the case of Leyden versus Town of Greenwich, which was decided by the Connecticut Supreme Court in 2001, which stated that towns like Greenwich could not have outright bans on non-residents. Greenwich was perhaps most extreme in that they just simply did not allow persons who did not live in Greenwich from using their town beach. The Connecticut Supreme Court said that was unconstitutional. So we've seen that, we no longer have those laws in place. But since then, we've continued to see more subtle means of exclusion, in particular the use, the requirement for beach passes, and how they're often much more difficult to obtain if you're a non-resident, and I should add, much more expensive. I was actually, the Hartford Courant last summer put together a list of beaches along the state shoreline and how much it would cost and what you had to do in order to access them. And some of the numbers are just jaw-dropping. For instance, it cost you $75 to park at the town beach in Clinton on a summer weekend if you're a non-resident. Just to park for one day, it will cost you $75. Now, some might argue that that is simply aimed at trying to dissuade non-residents, or certainly non-residents who don't have those kind of resources. So this is, you know, very characteristic of what you see up and down the shoreline, is while they can't deny access to non-residents, you often see other ways, in particular the use of parking and beach passes and exorbitantly expensive ones as a way of dissuading certain groups of people from using it.
I only have a minute before the break, but I'd like to talk about this when we come back. I have heard from certain town officials who have said in the past, look, it's expensive to run a beach. We do this for our residents. We have to charge a certain amount, especially if outsiders are going to come in and use our resources. And obviously, as you've stated, there are others who have said this is purely racist and discriminatory. That is a full conversation, and maybe we could address it as soon as we come back in about a minute, minute and a half, if you don't mind.
Sure, absolutely.
Sounds great. Andrew Carl, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Virginia. The book is Free the Beaches, The Story of Ned Cole and the Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. And the Hartford Current, it was last year, as a matter of fact, they did put together this report. It's pretty lengthy, and it details all the beaches, the public beaches in Connecticut and the town beaches, and how you can get onto the beach and how much it costs you. And as the professor said, it could be $35 a car load, $45, $75 to park. It's a lot of money. If you want to join in the conversation, email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org, or find us on Twitter. We're at FullStoryWSHU. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Full Story on WSHU. On a dreary Monday. What the heck happened to the spring? Where'd it go? And we're talking about the beaches today. Of course we are. Andrew Carl is with us. He's an associate professor of history and African American studies at the University of Virginia. He's with us on Skype. The professor wrote the book Free the Beaches, The Story of Ned Cole and the Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. Professor, just before we broke, we were talking about the different views of this. So what do you think when you hear town officials saying, look, I have to charge this amount because running this beach, running this park is expensive?
I think there is definitely a point to be made when it comes to the rising costs and expense for providing public recreational spaces. And that is in some ways a reflection of how we've, as a nation, have really disinvested in public recreation, often leaving it to localities to take care of this on their own. And in many ways, it often, you know, the wealthier the town, the more that they can provide their residents. And I think one thing that we, I think we need to sort of ask ourselves about how much we value public space and how well we can, you know, protect and ensure that it's truly open to the entire public. And I think, you know, sometimes it's unfair to place that burden on localities that are themselves strapped for cash and tax revenue. But I think, you know, it doesn't take away from the real, you know, importance of public space and how it's essential to a healthy democracy.
Professor, as you mentioned before, Ned Cole is still with us, and maybe one of these days he'll join us on the air. But what do you think Ned Cole would say about the situation today compared to the 60s and the 70s?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Ned in particular remains someone who's committed to some of the these ideals of an open and robust public. And I think, you know, for him as well, you know, this was just one of many issues that he dedicated his life to fighting. It was perhaps the one that got him the most attention and certainly touched the most nerves. But, you know, he is someone who has, you know, throughout his life has been really dedicated to serving and advocating on behalf of the poor. And that's a real, you know, important job in a state like Connecticut, which is a very unequal state. It has real profound gaps between its wealthy and its poor. And I think, you know, the work that the Revitalization Corps was doing was really critical to addressing some of the underlying needs in the state.
And Ned Cole wanted to change the world so much that at one point he even ended up running for president, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He ran for president in 1972, even though he was too young to serve as president.
So he was trying to displace Richard Nixon.
Yes. But I think, you know, he was really trying to make a point. And I think one of the things that, really drove his activism was this fear that Americans were becoming too cynical, too complacent, too disengaged from public life. I think he wanted to run for president to get young people involved in politics again, and to especially at a time where, after 4 years of Richard Nixon, many were growing disillusioned. So he decided to run for president. And, some might, a less charitable interpretation of it was is that he wanted to raise his own profile, which he certainly did, because he was, even though he couldn't serve as president, he was able to get into a nationally televised presidential debate where he shared the stage with George McGovern and Ed Muskie.
That's so great.
and most famously held up a rubber rat. He pulled it. He used a prop. He pulled it out of his coat pocket, held up a rubber rat to a gasping audience. And he did so in order to highlight what he saw as the underlying problem in America, which was poverty.
We have to get him on the air one of these days. he probably has some stories. Professor, I'm going to ask you to hold on 1 second. I want to invite someone to join the conversation with us. You mentioned volunteers, people who are trying to do things. I want to introduce you to Carl Irace. Carl is an attorney based out of East Hampton. He's the former secretary of the Eastern Long Island chapter of the Surf Rider Foundation. Carl, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
For those who don't know, and I know you from at least the foundation from California, what is the Surf Rider Foundation?
The Surf Rider Foundation is an international not-for-profit entity. It's a grassroots organization with local chapters all over the world, all over the country. I mean, we even have three chapters on Long Island, and they have several commitments and campaigns that are all about issues that are related to the shoreline. They involve clean water issues and water pollution and rising against disposable plastic use and beach access issues. Those are the main ones.
As I said, I know the foundation, but to be frank, I've known the group from its work off of Malibu and the California coastline. How many members do you have on Long Island? I think you said you have three chapters?
There are three chapters. I don't know the western or central details about the western or central chapters, but when I was the Eastern Long Island chapter secretary, and I was acting president for a while, I was our membership, I think, was nearly 300 people. I think it was 270-something.
A large group. What are the main issues, do you think, facing the beaches and the coastline in our region?
We see two things mostly. What we see are non-point source pollution issues that contaminate our bays or contribute to other surface water issues like algae blooms that can have adverse effects on finfish and shellfish and other marine life. But the big one where we see a lot of our more emotional battles and more acute battles is about shoreline access and making sure the public can use the beach. That's the big thing. That's the big nerve around here. What we see most often and most emotionally are homeowners and upland owners trying to harden their shorelines and trying to, build things to protect infrastructure or other construction, and they can build other things on the shoreline, and those contribute to the loss of the public's resource, the beach.
I don't know if you were able to hear part of our conversation before, but on the line with us still is Professor Andrew Carl. He wrote the book about Connecticut, and it's called Free the Beaches, the Story of Ned Cole and the Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. It sounds very similar in Connecticut to what is taking place on Long Island.
And what you talked about in Malibu, I mean, I think one of the biggest campaigns that's public access related that Surf Rider Foundation is involved with is one where somebody's attempting to say that the beach in front of their house is theirs, and to
preclude the public from being able even to pass and repass over it.
And what, because I got to spend over the last few years some time out in Malibu, and what always struck me is when that issue would come up, some of the people who were trying to restrict access were well-known Democratic big-ticket supporters. And people I spoke with out there said, this doesn't make any sense. If they're part of this party, they should be doing this.
Well, a lot of, it's funny you mentioned, I heard you earlier discussing a very confusing and polarizing figure in American history. President Richard Nixon is actually the president who signed the Coastal Zone Management Act into law, and along with the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Air and Clean Water Act, and the Coastal Zone Management Act is expressed locally, and the states have their own coastal management programs, and in New York we have local expressions of those policies.
Professor Carl, I know you're patiently listening. It does sound similar, doesn't it, to what takes place here in Connecticut?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of my book tells the story of the Open Beaches movement that brought us the Coastal Zone Management Act, brought us the California Coastal Commission, which has, along with the Surf Rider Foundation, really been fighting to protect public access rights along the Pacific Shore. In many respects, what was happening in Connecticut in the 1970s was a microcosm of what was happening across coastal America, that increasingly Americans were growing frustrated with the diminished public access and also the overdevelopment of shorelines. This was both a social movement and an environmental protection movement aimed at both restoring public access rights that were slipping out of their hands as development continued to increase, and also protecting shorelines, ecology, from the damaging effects of privatization. I think, in particular, we can begin to see how what was happening in Connecticut was really, part of a broader national story, which groups like the Surf Rider Foundation have been tirelessly fighting on behalf of both Americans' rights to the shore, as well as fighting to protect the shores themselves.
Carl, has the situation gotten better or worse on Long Island in terms of beach access?
I think it is a constant, never-ending battle, because you often have new interests coming in and trying to assert themselves in all sorts of different ways. Fortunately, we have the Coastal Zone Management Act, and we have our local expression of it. Our town has what's called a local waterfront revitalization program. That's the local expression of the policies of the CZMA. And we have those things, but making sure that the public is educated about what these things now mean, and to have a government that can administrate these policies and know how to use this valuable tool I feel almost like a missionary at times trying to trying to educate people about the tools that they have. I mean, the LWRP and the Coastal Zone Management Act are pretty clear, and they're under constant attack from new interests coming in and trying to do things that violate the policies. That, in general, something that violates the policies is something that favors a non-water dependent use over a water dependent use, or something that prioritizes one water dependent use over another. And you can see how on the ocean side we'd see beachgoers, or there are even professional fishermen that earn their livelihoods off of the beach, whether it's by truck and net fishing or even pinhookers that catch with a rod and reel and then sell fish. I mean, having things that obstruct the public's use of the beach isn't just about somebody that wants to, it can be something as small as somebody walking their dog, but it can also have larger implications to different types of people that aren't necessarily who you see on a Saturday afternoon on a blanket in July.
Carl, The professor and I were talking before about this article that came out in the Hartford Current, I believe it was last summer or so, last June or July. And it listed the beaches up and down Connecticut and what you had to do to get on. And there are some, as the professor was saying before, where if you want to go to the beach, just parking there will cost you $75 for the day if you're a non-resident. Does Long Island have that problem too?
Yes and no. Long Island has, you know, on the western end, there are city beaches for the city of New York, and the city of Long Beach and a couple of other oceanfront villages like Lido. But then you have Nassau. In Nassau County, you have Jones Beach, and that is a state park, and anyone from the state can go there for the fee. And I can remember as a kid, it was $8. $8 for a carload. I don't know what it is now. I assume it's gone up. But you know, locally, for the state accessed beaches, you can, you know, the fees are set similarly statewide, and the town beaches often have their own. The town and village beaches have their own policies, and there are county beaches also where you can pay by the day. $75 sounds higher than anything that I'm aware of, but I think you'd definitely see 50. Mm. And for a carload of people, maybe that's five people in it, that's $10 a head. That's cheaper than going to the movies.
Yes, it is, especially if you have to buy yourself a big gulp or something like that. Professor Carl, where does this go the next few years? More of the same?
Well, I think you've continued to see, as I try to show in my book, that these battles over public access to public space often both reflect and reinforce larger struggles over segregation within housing markets, within schools, and really in some ways are parallel inequality within the nation as a whole. So until we begin to address some of the problems that kind of push us farther apart as a society, we're going to continue to see battles over beach access and access to other public spaces continue to be a feature of, you know, of our politics.
Carl, I know the Surfrider Foundation, it just doesn't work with beach access. You have many issues that you try to deal with. We've done a number of programs on global warming and climate change. In terms of beach access and where the beaches are, do you find that to be a top priority for members of the foundation?
I mean, I can't speak exactly to what the priorities of the individual members are. Also, I more frequently work with another organization now that has been much more vocal on some of the local issues that we spend. That's called Defend H2O. And, you know, the issues that we see with global warming are also related to access issues because, you know, what we think of as the beach now, if sea level rises, it moves. You know, it moves landward, and the more hard structures there are landward, even can affect the ability of the public to use the common resource, the beach. I mean, it's there for everyone. It's a limited resource, but it is shared in common by everyone. Mm. And everyone has a right to it. I mean, that's the premise of the Coastal Zone Management Act and other laws that, you know, aren't just environmental in nature.
With the minute that we have left, where do you think this all ends up in the next few years? How do you see it evolving?
I really wish that more people and decision makers, whether they're in the non-governmental world or the governmental world or just the public, would be educated more about where, you know, what these policies are there to protect. And I think that would really help us get through the next few years. And we'll keep working on it.
Carl Irace. Carl is an attorney based out of East Hampton. As he mentioned, he works with Defend H2O, and he's also the former secretary and acting president of the Eastern Long Island chapter of the Surfrider Foundation. Carl, thank you. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Carl is an associate professor of history and African American studies at the University of Virginia. He joined us on Skype today. He wrote the book Free the Beaches, The Story of Ned Cole and the Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. Professor, thank you. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Be well and enjoy the summer.
Yes, you as well.
Thank you. If you would like to join the conversation, you could email us, tfs@wshu.org. You can find us on Twitter. We're at FullStoryWSHU. And there's always voicemail. Not too many people call it nowadays, but you know, you might be one of them. Our number is 833-CALL-TFS. That comes out to 833-225-5837. This is The Full Story. I'm Ron Ropiak. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back. This is The Full Story on WSHU, and after a pretty boring winter, we've all been itching to get out to the beaches and the state parks. Well, the weather's just about there. Not really summer weather yet, but it's tolerable. So the questions are, what beach or park will you be heading to? Will you need a permit or pass to get into it? How much is it going to cost you to get onto what is ostensibly public and not private land? We have lots and lots of questions. We're going to try and get some answers over the next day or two. Eileen Grant is joining us now. Eileen is a co-president of the Friends of Connecticut State Parks. Hi, Eileen. Thanks for coming on today.
Oh, you're welcome. Hi.
So it seems self-explanatory, but what is Friends of Connecticut State Parks?
Well, we're a coalition of 29 different volunteer friends groups that work to promote and enhance our local parks. So we began with only six or seven members in the early 90s, and because of the needs and the virtues of parks, we've grown to 29 groups today and are still growing.
29 groups, and how many people?
I'd say probably somewhere between 7,500 and 8,000 members.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I assume you're always looking for more.
Yes, we are. And, you know, we usually don't have too much trouble attracting volunteers. I mean, you have the most lovely places in the state to volunteer in, so it can be a bit of an easy sell.
So are you one of those nice people I see when I go to the parks? There's someone marking out the trails, clearing debris, picking up someone's disgusting trash. Is that you?
Those would be the poor paid maintenance workers. The friends have the opportunity to pick and choose what we would like to do, and we do some. I mean, we do clear, help clear trails and do clean, special cleanups and so forth. But then we also host educational programming, and we help a little bit with promotion and publicity. And, talk about the history of our parks. And then we also try to raise money for some big projects as well, capital projects.
You're good people. Okay, if I can ask you a bit of a personal question. Did you grow up in Connecticut?
Yes, I did. I grew up in the center of the state in Cromwell.
All right.
As a child, my family came down to Hammonasset several times in a summer, and
beautiful,
it was always
state
kind
park.
Of a dream place for us.
Absolutely. But the reason I ask that question is because some older Connecticutians tell me it was much more open to get and easier to get to the parks and beaches when they were kids. What happened? Are they right about that?
Well, the parks themselves, I would say it's the same ease of access. Because our entry roads and so forth have not changed a bit, but I mean the shoreline in general is certainly less open, and the residences are larger and closer together, and the feel of the communities, I would say, is certainly different from when I came as a girl, and even when I moved to the town that I live in, Madison, 30 years ago. And it's changed markedly since that time.
So what do you think? Should they be open more? Should they be more accessible? And if so, how should that be done?
I think they should be more accessible. That's a tough nut, though, because people are very, as I'm sure that tremendously protective of their neighborhoods and access and so forth. And you know, every person is different, but I would say in general that neighborhoods might not be particularly welcoming because they, you know, they fear a lack of privacy and a lot of vehicles and you know, some people fear crime mm-hmm. because people coming into their neighborhoods they don't know and so forth. So there's a lot of resistance to overcome in order to get people more readily to the shoreline.
Hmm. But, you know, as a kid growing up in New York, I went to Coney Island and Rockaway, and they were great. But let's admit it, come, you know, midsummer and so on, they could be filthy. And that's, I'm not saying that's the case for all public beaches, but if we're being honest, shouldn't there be some sort of system in place where people pay something because some people just don't care? They throw garbage, they leave a mess, and that goes right across the board for beaches and parks.
Well, I'd say we're pretty lucky in our shoreline parks because our maintenance people are very vigilant, and it's more difficult out in the more remote locations, and water bodies do attract a lot of raucous behavior. So you know, some riverside state park locations and ponds and lakes can be a problem, especially if there's a convergence between a residential neighborhood and the state park, because sometimes half a lake will be residential persons and the other half will be a state park, and so then you can get a lot of friction in that kind of close quarters. So and garbage problems can definitely be a problem. And parking, you know, when people have their driveways blocked and you know, everybody's turning around in their yards and so forth, people get a little irritable. so it can be tough. I'd say our shoreline beaches in general look pretty good.
Are you looking for more funding from the state?
Yes, and we have recently, you probably have heard, just last year, we had the final framework of the Passport to Parks passed through the legislature, which has been wonderful. So now for a $10 fee on one's registration for a two-year period or $5 per year, any Connecticut resident can get into any Connecticut state park for free. So all our shoreline parks are wide open for free to any resident of the state, which is really great because, you know, they were not cheap to come to on weekends.
No.
I mean, that $15 a day for some families is really a strain. And so being able to provide that so that a family can come not one weekend or two weekends a season, but any weekend they feel like it is very, very nice.
And,
so we have had, you know, a real a 10% uptick in visitation just the first year.
That's great news. And because some of the parks are just stunning, they're absolutely beautiful. And with that in mind, I have a final question for you. What's your favorite beach in the entire state? And maybe also your favorite park.
Oh, I'm torn.
I put you on the spot, huh?
That's not nice. I live close to Hammonasset, so I walk there probably every day of the week. So I love Hammonasset, but I began as a volunteer at Harkness Memorial State Park in Waterford, where you can't swim, but it's seaside also, but it has world-renowned gardens, and I'm by profession a garden designer, so that's where I began my volunteer life for state parks in 1996. So I certainly love Harkness as well.
Eileen Grant is a co-president of the Friends of Connecticut State Parks. Eileen, I hope you have a wonderful summer, and I'm sure you'll be getting out to all the parks as much as you can. I appreciate you coming on today, and I hope you come back and join us in the future.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for asking.
And if you would like to join the conversation, you can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. Follow us on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. And the voicemail number is always open for you, 833-CALL-TFS. Today, we're discussing the beaches in our region, specifically how do we get onto them, which many of us will be trying to do as soon as the weather gets warm in a month or two. With us now is George Gorman, Regional Director, New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. George, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, and thanks for having me.
George, you are someone who has a direct impact on many of us, and I'll bet most of our listeners haven't heard your name before.
Well, that's not nice to say.
You're the guy who runs Long Island State Park beaches. When we go
that's
to the
correct.
Beach and we sit there and we say, this is beautiful, we should be saying, thanks, George.
No, there's a lot of people that they should thank for. Everyone from the park worker all the way up to the park manager. That's who takes care of the facilities. And they do an amazing job. But the beachfronts, such as the major beachfronts, Jones Beach, Robert Moses, all the way around to Montauk, and then the North Fork of Long Island, those, we have a significant amount of beaches that draw about 14 million visitors.
14 million. That's incredible.
Yep, and it's the vast majority like to swim. And so we have about 500 lifeguards that take care of the swimming public at those facilities. And it's an amazing operation. And we encourage public transportation. We encourage everyone to visit those beaches because that's why they were built. If everybody goes back to the days of Robert Moses when he built them, it was for the every person to go onto the beaches to enjoy them. Back then in the 1929, 1930s, up until that point, the beaches were pretty much exclusive to a lot of wealthy individuals and, the people that had built the mansions all around both the North and South Shore of Long Island. And now we have these amazing beaches where anyone can enjoy.
George, as a kid, I used to go to Robert Moses a lot and Jones Beach. Loved them. How much does it cost to get onto them nowadays?
Right now, it's $10 for a car. And it could be as many people as you want that could fit in the car legally. And we have an Empire Passport that anyone can also enjoy. But also, we have bus service. We have railroad train and then bus service that meets the trains to bring them onto the beaches. And actually, 2 years ago, that had been reduced by the local bus service. So we were not having significant busing. We only had weekends. So Governor Cuomo stepped in and provided the funding and the resources to reopen that so that everyone from New York City, Connecticut, New Jersey, or wherever could then enjoy the beaches full-time every day from Memorial Day to Labor Day.
That's great. Now, it's $10 for New York State residents. Is it a little
Correct.
Bit? Is it a little bit more for out-of-state?
No, it is the same for any.
Oh, that's what you were saying. You were saying anyone. It's $10 across
anyone.
The board.
Correct. Anyone. Doesn't matter where you're from, it's $10 per car to get in.
And I could try and fit 15 people in my car, like the old days.
Do you know how I said legally?
I heard that.
Originally?
I picked up on that, and I got to tell you, I have memories of many of us being jammed into one car.
Yeah, me too. That's why I said legally. We used to do the same thing. I had a very large family and neighborhood.
Hey, George, as someone who's been watching this for 30 years, we're doing a program tomorrow about it, and so I just want to pick your brain for 1 second. Global warming, climate change, are you seeing drastic changes at the state parks?
We have been. We have been seeing the effects, erosion, some storms, more so than we ever have. That is correct.
And is there anything that you could do to combat it, or is Mother Nature simply going to win this one?
Well, we've done a lot of resiliency in accommodating that are boardwalks we've made so that they are more resilient and the water passes through and then recedes. All of our electrical system, our infrastructure has been risen so that we adjust. It comes in, it goes out. And with replenishment, we've put sand in areas to support and to make sure that the beaches remain the same. We've done natural replenishment mainly. That way, it's nature, and it won't erode as much. People have talked about hardening and doing all sorts of things. Well, we don't tend to do that. We do more soft, meaning more natural replenishment, some more natural setups for the Mother Nature, because we know it's coming, so we have to address.
14 million people use the beaches every single year. Do you have enough money in your budget to take care of all of this? Obviously, it's a huge part of the economy for tourism, for the towns. Do you get enough support from the state?
We have our annual appropriation, and we have a significant annual appropriation to ensure that we're able to provide the services that we need to for any of the park visitors. In addition, Governor Cuomo and the New York State Legislature have developed a 2020 plan where we are getting a tremendous amount of funding to rebuild Long Island State Parks and all New York State Parks, to rebuild our facilities so that they are ready for the future. A lot of our facilities this year, Jones Beach, Hempstead Lake, Sunken Meadow, a whole bunch of beachfronts are celebrating 90 years of service. So this is a great thing that the legislature agreed with the governor, and we are rebuilding. We're getting ready for the next 90 years. All of our facilities were in decay. They look terrible. And now we're rebuilding. And in rebuilding, guess what? That's attracting more visitors. Mm. So that's been a big, big boom for us. We went from 20 million visitors. We're close to 25 million visitors right now, annually.
So looking down the line, 10 years from now, and obviously you and I already talked about global warming and climate change, what are you working on to combat it, to make it more accessible to everyone in the future?
Well, again, anytime we rebuild anything, we're rebuilding it so it's higher, so that it's more resilient. We're rebuilding it so we know if the water comes in and a high tide surge, that it'll go back out and that it won't damage us, you know, it won't have significant damage. So we've done a lot of rebuilding and a lot of preparing to make sure that we are ready and that if we do see higher tides or if we do see the effects of global warming, that what we're putting in place will minimize that effect. And that will keep the beaches open and keep the public available so that they can enjoy it.
Memorial Day is coming up. What do you expect? Record numbers?
Well, this year, you know, it's all weather. If God is good to us, we have a great weather season where the sun is out, we're at about 80 to 90 degrees, we will have a great summer. And again, we've been building up each year to last year's record of 25 million at Long Island State Parks. So we have the United States Air Force Thunderbirds and a beautiful air show over Jones Beach Memorial Day weekend. And right now I'm at the PGA Championship, not a beachfront park, but a golf park at Bethpage State Park. And it's phenomenal. We have a great amount of programs and services that we do provide to the park visitors.
Are you watching them get in the practice round?
No, I'm talking to you on the radio.
I thought you could do two at once. Well,
no,
do me a favor and say hi to Tiger for me.
Yeah, okay. Like, I will see him.
George, you're no longer anonymous. I thank you for your time, and it was very nice of
you.
Be well. George Gorman is Regional Director, New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. We also were talking before with Eileen Grant and Carl Irace and Professor Andrew Carl. The professor is an associate professor of history and African-American studies at the University of Virginia. The book that he wrote, and we've gotten some questions about it, Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Coll, that's C-O-L-L, and the Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Coll and the Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. That'll do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chifari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.